approach to alcoholics and to...
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be in Montana. I like Montana. I'm glad to see a number of people I've known other places. Kenny and his wife, Katrina, from Southern California. And I know most of you heard and enjoyed Pat Roach this noon at the Al-Anon meeting. And tomorrow morning you'll hear her husband, Cliff, who's a very excellent AA example and speaker. I'm glad to see my granddaughter, kind of, Kimmy, over here. Remember, she was a little girl, and she was a bad little girl, now that I think about it. Well, she needed to find this rigidity and structure and strength of Pony Montana. For everything you do, there are six houses going. The bitch is doing it again. Yeah. That keeps you straight when all else fails, I'll tell you. And I'm glad to see my friend Dick M. and his faithful assistant Mark. They were telling me they drove all the way from Lincoln or Omaha, Nebraska to tape this. That's two long, hard days of driving. And after we're all home again, they'll be still up there in the mountains somewhere. Put on another tape, Mark. Not the ones we heard. They put me to sleep. Well, you're a couple of dummies, that's what you are. You'd be nothing without sponsorship, I'll tell you that. Hey, I want to thank Larry B. Mump for coming to the airport and being a good host to me yesterday and opening the doors as I was carrying my bags. And hope I wasn't inconveniencing you, Larry. No, he really was a good host. I don't want to be mean to him. And this has been a very nice day, and it's a very nice meeting. I haven't been able to be as active as I wanted to because I have a little infection in my throat. And the Jesus. I told you to wear a condom. That's pretty funny. I work where people die from alcoholism and drug addiction in the back of the alley. We were joking about the other day, not much to joke about, but there are guys who line up back there and shoot dope till they die, and we've dead bodies every morning. And one of my guys said, he went back there and said, you know, be careful now, you're just using this needle and passing it around, you're going to get AIDS. So one guy said, don't worry about me, I'm wearing a condom. I hate to bring this sex talk to Montana, but anyway, I have a little infection in my throat, and I haven't been able to talk as much as I wanted, but I've gone to some of the meetings, and I've enjoyed them. The first complaint has been registered. Where do you get these foul-mouthed bastards? Sign all the guys up in the Whitefish group. But we had a good meeting today on the traditions, and we had some other meetings, and it's been a very pleasant day, and it's a good day because people seem to be kind of up, and it's always good to go to conventions where people are up. That's one of the great reasons I like to go to Canada. Although Canada is now getting big and successful enough, they're getting just starting to get a little jaded now, but for many, many years, they've always been, because they've had, many people have vast distances to go to meetings, and they really had to put themselves out to do these things. And the harder you have to work for AA, it seems like the more you appreciate it. I think one of the reasons that helped me appreciate AA so much, has helped me maintain it, is that I almost died as a slipper again and again, because I did not know what the hell I was dealing with, and I took it for granted, and I thought it was just some sort of another piece of philosophy that people were cramming down my throat, and I had no idea what was happening to me. So the worst years of my life came after I was exposed to AA, after I first went to AA. You know, when I first went to AA, I felt kind of bad, because they said, gee, because I'd been in jail a couple times, and I had hope to have a future of being somewhat successful, and you feel kind of bad having been in jail. But after I went to AA, I went to jail 32 times. So that helped me a great deal and improve my story. Before I went to AA, I'd been in a hospital once, been in a naval hospital at the end of the Second World War, prior to discharge, getting prepared to go back in the world. And after I came to AA, I was in all kinds of hospitals, and I was dried out in the hospitals, and I was chained down in hospitals, and I was in a veterans hospital psych ward, and I was committed to the Texas State Insane Asylum for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life. And I like to think that none of these things would have happened to me if I hadn't been inspired by Alcoholics Anonymous, too. And the last day I ever drank, I stood on Skid Row in Los Angeles, and I had no front teeth, no clothes, my old t-shirt, no pair of pants, no pair of tennies. I'd just been thrown out of a Skid Row mission and told to stay out. And I felt no more like an alcoholic that day than I did the first day I went to AA years before that. Because there was always one thing in my life that no matter what happened to me, always was a constant. And that is somehow deep inside of me, I had a feeling. When I was able to identify it, I thought it was rather unusual and unique. And I thought I might be the only one in the world who has this feeling. And the feeling was, my case truly is different from those who are trying to help me. And I'll tell you, it's kind of an interesting thing. Today, well, you younger folks, the ones of you who are still here who haven't gone upstairs for pizza. Wish they'd ask me. But I'm not terribly old. I'm old, but not terribly old. I pitched a doubleheader a couple weeks ago, so I'm not dying of old age yet. But when I was... could you give me some French fries and a hamburger and a... You notice they didn't go around pouring coffee during the Al-Anon meeting. They would have been released. But in my lifetime, when I was a little boy... When I was a little boy, the best doctor in the world, the best, most knowledgeable and notable doctor in the world, stated that to the best of his knowledge, there was no therapeutic in the world at that time that helped alcoholics stay sober. That was the early 1930s. And just stop and think, that is, I mean, seems like a long time ago, the 1930s, but it really isn't, when people have been... People like you and me have been feeling different and drinking alcohol and running our lives into problems for 5,000 years, just 55 years ago, the best doctor in the world told a man with a blank check in his hand and a prestigious family behind him and was willing to spend any amount of money to do whatever was necessary, and he said, keep your money. There is no help available to an alcoholic in the world today. Now, apart from the startling fact of a person turning down money to cure alcoholics, I wish we could. I wish you'd bite some of the people around today. But you and I are very, very fortunate to be here, but it's hard to remember that. And most of us never knew it and don't understand it. All we know is that my case is different. As we know, in 1935, two people, indirectly as a part of that conversation, very indirectly, got together and formed an organization that over a period of time has become the most successful therapeutic in the treatment of alcoholism in the history of the world. In fact, I think it's safe to say that more people have been helped by the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous successfully than by all other therapies combined in the last 5,000 years. Now, that sounds a little spooky, but that's true. And yet, we just take it for granted. We take it for granted. But the AA has grown, and most of us know, you know, that these guys kind of, they were both members of something called the Oxford Movement, and they got together, and they're going to help each other, and one of them had a spiritual experience before that. And the one thing this doctor, Dr. Jung, had told this fellow in Switzerland, he said, every so often, maybe one in a million, one in 5 million, but an alcoholic will have a rather intense psychological readjustment, which they describe as a spiritual experience. And these people, for some reason, can stay sober. But the chances of getting that are one, as I say, one in a million. You have almost as much chance of being hit by lightning as you do of getting a spiritual experience and being made sober. So the kid didn't have much interest in that. But one of the founders, the two founders of this group, had a spiritual experience. And he got another guy together. They, little by little, they called on another guy. They tried to talk to him. Because the whole concept of AA has always been calling on people. The Oxford Movement was sitting around talking about spiritual matters. When these two guys got together, this doctor and this stockbroker, they sat for 2 weeks and talked about spiritual matters. The following week, the doctor was back drunk again, face down. When he got him sobered up again, and they got going again, instead of sitting around talking about spiritual matters, what they did instead was go to the Akron, Ohio hospital and find some other boob to talk to. His name was Bill D, and he was a lawyer from Kentucky who had moved to Akron. And I heard him talk years ago. And of course, he was a drinker like all of us, and he'd been getting a lot of heat, a lot of crap from everybody, and you know. And he said, I'll lay in that hospital. Up in Akron, Ohio. My wife came in. She said, Bill, there's two fellas out there who want to talk to you about your drinking. And I thought, oh, crap. She made me talk to them fellas. And the damnedest thing, they never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe how I felt before. And that so impressed me, I wanted to stick with them fellers. I've been with them ever since. And then the three of them called on some other boob named Ernie. Ernie was a nice-looking young guy, and he got to be kind of one of the family with the Smiths, Dr. Bob's family. He married Dr. Bob's daughter. And he became the first in a series of things we've seen in AA. He got to be part of the family, and her love and their warmth would keep him going. He didn't go on many calls like the rest of them did because he was married to Dr. Bob's daughter. He got drunk and died. Funny. That's how it goes. I'll tell you something. I have a daughter, my youngest daughter, Susan. When I was about 5 years, no, I was sober a long time, but a guy I sponsored, when he was sober about 5 years, he got going with my daughter. And I try to discourage it nicely, but they got married. And God, I'll tell you, if you want to, if you ever want to know the true meaning of mixed emotions, watch your daughter go down the aisle with somebody whose fifth step you've heard.
Oh,
you're bound by the secret, see? But you can hint, you can say to them, oh, call me if ever brings the sheep home, honey. As it turned out, though, he turned out to be a good husband. They've got a bunch of children, and they're all living happily ever after. But it's a kind of a funny thing. When I grind him, I have to stop and think, now, which hat do I have on? Do I have my father-in-law hat on, or my sponsor, or my just good citizen? What's the matter with you? Oh, there, you're doing well. But anyway, so this little group formed, and by 1937 or 38, there may be 70 or 80 people sober. Bill was back in New York, and his doctor was in Ohio. And Bill decided to write a book for two reasons. One, the people wanted to see how it would all come out. They wanted to be able to communicate what they'd found. And secondly, they hoped that maybe it would help them raise some money to do their work. They didn't know any better then, and they thought they could build a hospital and do this and that. And this guy sat down and wrote this book. And that book was read from tonight. And it was written in exactly that same style. One word changed, I think, from the time it was written until it was read tonight. This guy wrote this in 1938, and it's been the standard text of our program ever since. And there's anybody in AA who's not familiar with the AA book. And it just gets to be another old ho-hummer, those old-timers quote from it, and it's just hideous. And I'll tell you something about that book. One of the great things about that book is that almost everywhere in every city, there's always somebody who is kind of the local imitation intellectual who will say things like, well, when I came to the program, I read this book and I thought it was very badly written. Well, I've been a professional writer all my adult life. That's how I made my living, mostly. It started off in sports writing a long time ago, and then advertising agencies and public relations agencies and radio and television and motivational writings. And when I read this book, the first time I read it, I didn't think it was a badly written book. I thought it was a mediocrely written book. I thought the guy was trying to do a good job. But there's one problem with this book for a fellow like me who's involved in getting people into action. And that is, this damn book never gets anywhere. I want to see exclamation points and do this now and suggestions. And this book was it's a nice little book, but it's not one you'd want to spend a lot of time reading if you want to be awake. Well, some years later, when, as I mentioned, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I was on Skid Row. And I got off of there one more time, and some old hideous sponsor who didn't understand that sponsoring means sharing. He thought it meant telling, intimidating, scaring, getting ego satisfaction at the expense of people who are temporarily down and out. He made me take actions and read that dumb book, and I went to a lot of meetings, and as I stayed sober over a period of time, and I got to sponsor people, and somewhere in those first few years, I remember when I was a few years sober, suddenly thinking about this, because someone asked me about it, I had come to the conclusion that this was a remarkable book, and I'll tell you, shortly after that, and thereafter, and until tonight, I have a growing, and I believe, absolute confidence that this book is divinely inspired. Now, that sounds a little hokey, because AA is full of people who are always seeing miracles where none exist. You know, I saw a miracle this morning. The sun came out of the clouds. You know, when you're a pragmatist, you know, geez. If you want to see a miracle, get my wife to stop talking. But I'm not much of one for miracles or unusual things, because that's just not my style. So when I say this book is divinely inspired, it took me a long time to come to believe it. And I believe it's the only book, or perhaps one of two books that I have ever heard of, that I believe to be divinely inspired. There's a lot of books, and I've read most of them, but this is the only... Now, why would you think this book is divinely inspired, just because some boob wrote a book that helps the people? Two reasons. First of all, the guy who wrote it did not know enough to write it. True story. He was sober 3 years. And I'll tell you something. He had no background in psychology, no background in abnormal psychology, no knowledge of medicine. It was based on watching people, most of whom were returned to drinking. Most of the early members of AA returned to drinking. We forget that. We think they all stayed sober. They didn't. Most of them died drunk. So-called 100 people in this book, which were really 79, most of them died drunk. Because that's the way it is with alcoholics. Most of them die drunk. And he wrote this book without any background, and he wrote a book that has, as I said, now just stop and think about this, has altered more alcoholic lives than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. Now that is some kind of unusual. And secondly, when I say he didn't know enough to write it, I'm sure there are new people here tonight who think, well, geez, he was sober 3 years. He should know enough to write a book by now. Let me tell you some bad news. You will discover when you are sober 3 years that you don't know as much as you thought you would. By the time you're sober 5 years, you just patronize people 3 years sober. Still going to meetings, Billy? Keep it up. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober for your coffee. Because they, is that two creams and one sugar or two sugars? Never mind, I'll do it myself. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Nothing personal. Just want to see how they're going to turn out when they get some time. But here's this guy who wrote that book. And he was an alcoholic, and he was a very human alcoholic. We like to imbue these guys with superhuman wonderfulness, but they weren't. Because if you had to be superhuman wonderfully to be sober, none of us would make it. What makes AA so unusual is that fallible, obsessed, tormented sometimes, up and down people can come here and find ways to change their lives and make it better. And this guy was among the great humans of all time. And he wrote this book, and he wrote it for bad motives. He's going to make dough out of it. And they didn't. And he didn't even realize what he'd written. It just seemed to be a lot of things. Many of the things in that book had never been come up in AA. He just put them together. And yet that book has altered more lives than a lot of people. I'll tell you, here's kind of an interesting thing when you stop and think about it. There probably are more sober people in this room tonight than were on the West Coast in 1935. But we just kind of take it for granted. What? So what? Big deal. But we somehow have to start remembering what an unusual thing it is so we can cherish this. But anyway, A finally grew. And we all know grew. Now it's 1.5 million people. It's nearly all the countries in the world, and some of you I know were at the International Convention in Montreal, 1985, and sat in that big football stadium full of sober alcoholics, the largest gathering of sober alcoholics in the history of the world. And that was just a small percentage of the sober alcoholics in the world. And people there from all the nations and all these boobs with their flags, national flags. That's where my voice first started to go. I was directing the flag ceremony on the field, and I had pretty good luck with most of the people. But there's one fool from Poland. He really just... I'm not putting down Polish people. Mother Nature beat me to it, that's why. I... you know. I'd say to them, I'd say, hey, we're trying to help you. We only got a few minutes. Be like everybody else when we say, Poland, go. Don't go. And he'd smile at me and go, brum, brah, rah, rah, rah. Well, he later fled Poland and now lives in Santa Monica. I'm trying to find him so I can not talk to him. That was an enormous thing. So you and I are very lucky people in this convention tonight. We live in about 1% of human history where it is not literally essential for an alcoholic to do the things that doctor described in 1932. He said, if you be alcoholic, there are only certain things you can do. You could either have yourself confined, either voluntarily or involuntarily, or else you must surely intermittently drink until you go mad or die. That's all an alcoholic can do. And all of our medical insight tells us this. So this is the first time in history where it is necessary. You stop and think all the people for all those years, people like you and me who were sensitive, who wanted things to be as right, who would love to be in a place like this, but there was no place to go. Can you imagine what that must be like to be a drinker and no place to go? And everybody's hand against you. Rich families sent their alcoholic members away. Most of Georgia, much of Australia was settled by English alcoholic children. Just get them out of here. Put them in nut houses. Put them in jails. Tell them you don't care. Lock them up. Write, erase their names from the family tree, out of the family Bible. He's not our son anymore. I mean, it sounds hokey now, but this used to break people's heart. And just up, except for the luck of being born when we were born, that's you and me. Because you think, well, I wouldn't do that. Yeah, you would do it. But we are living in an area today, or an era, when it's not necessary to die from drinking or go mad. And especially in America, where AA is more prevalent than anywhere in the world, there's only one small cloud. And that is this. Today, with all the help available, AA, and there are some people who can't seem to bring themselves to go to AA, so they can be somehow, some of them can be squeezed in through the treatment center, where they'll meet alcoholics of a better type. And if you can't afford that, there are counselors behind every bush. But today, there's no reason for anybody to die drunk. And you know a sad thing? It is estimated today, 1986-87, that in America, where all the help is centered, about 95 out of 100 alcoholics die drunk. That's today, with all the help. And think what it must have been before there was all the help available. And you say, how can that be? People don't have to die drunk anymore. Well, I see alcoholics die every day. Of course, I'm in a little different position than you are, but I see alcoholics die just about every day. I don't mean die figuratively, I mean literally. Well, we put a blanket over them and get into the morgue. And I see alcoholics almost every day going into alcoholic insanity, which is not, incidentally, acting badly. It's acting, not being able to function at all. It's almost more like catatonia. If you want to see alcoholic insanity, you go to a hospital and watch a guy sit there and look at the wall, and people come 3 times a day and change his diapers and feed him and put him to bed and get him up and change his diapers. And that goes on, and they can never get better. It's very much the same as the final stages of syphilis, except syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholism, your brain can go, and you can sit like that for 40 years. Sometimes your families come by to see him. You don't know that. Very similar to Alzheimer's. But now, of course, I see this because I work in the middle of Skid Row. Sure, I'd be liable to see it. But Skid Row deaths are only 3% of alcoholic deaths. The other 97% of people are people like you and me, and we've got shirts and dresses and homes and sometimes children. And you wonder, why in the hell would that be necessary? I know, a few years ago when I resigned a job, in Beverly Hills to go down and run this mission on Skid Row. One of my goals was trying to help these people off the street as I'd been helped off. And I tried to work with them, and gotta get them guys out there. You don't have to die, you're dying. Come on! And they'd nod, but I always wound back up on the street. And I thought, why? These people are dying. Why don't... And I've got a way that doesn't cost anything, and all they got to do is extend themselves. And it finally took me a while to understand why they couldn't do it. Then I thought, isn't that funny? It's the same reason that all alcoholics everywhere cannot make use of AA. Or the ones that can make use of AA have another reason that I believe to be absolutely ever-present. That isn't a big dramatic reason. It isn't a big psychological mountain. It's just a small feeling, and I've had it, and I still have it from time to time, and you have it, and all alcoholics in the world have it, and we'll never get rid of it. But we can diminish it so it doesn't kill us. And all it is, you want to know what it requires to just die drunk from alcoholism? All you have to do is maintain this idea. I know you're trying to help me. And what you say undoubtedly is true for many people. But my case is different. That's all it takes. That's all it takes. Because when my case is different from what you're talking about, it's ridiculous for me to do that stuff. Because my problem is different. And that's what causes people like you and me to die. And the sad thing is, as I said, you will never get over that feeling. You show me a person who doesn't still have the feeling, who no longer has the feeling deep inside of them, I am different. But you can only be, you can get into an area where you're just different to an extent. And sometimes you got to do things in AA, you find out, you act as though you don't feel different. But that takes a while to do that. And I look over my life and I think, gee, did I, people say, why didn't I get the program? Why didn't I get the program in 1949 when they took me out of jail and took me to the AA meeting? Why didn't I get the program year after year after that, when I'd go to AA intermittently between my psychoanalysis and my metaphysical insights and my readings of deep books and my running from town to town and knowing that, by God, there's something different about me and going to AA doesn't help it? Because AA is for people whose problem is drinking. And my problem is not really drinking, although I drink maybe more than they, some of them do. But my case is different. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink to overcome feelings they don't understand. And it's all very funny and very humorous. And you see enough people die thinking that same thought. I'll tell you something sad about it. The number of people in this room tonight who just had a good dinner and who feel good and are with their friends are going to die drunk. Maybe me and maybe you. I don't know who. But we have something up ahead because it won't make any difference how you feel tonight. It's like that book says, somewhere up ahead there'll be tests, not a formal test, but it'll look as though your life has dropped out from under you, or something terrible has happened, or you've been deprived of something you love, or whatever it might be. And then your continual sobriety will be measured on how you have been able to maintain your spiritual condition when things were going good and there was no apparent need to do it. Now, when we talk about spiritual condition, we don't mean religious. We mean doing the things that AA suggests, of going to the meetings and trying to straighten out things and being of help to others and carrying the message from time to time and putting my own will out of the way. But sometimes when you're going good and things get all right again, these become very dull things and people don't want to do them. We all have seen that. When I say that some of the people in this room tonight will die, it doesn't mean that I'm happy about it or you're happy about it, because I may be one of them. But what it means, whether there's a group of sober alcoholics, is just see if there's a certain amount of us who will say, I'm okay now, I don't need that anymore. Now it's time for me to get mine, to make up for lost time, to get my financial and my prestige and my juice going for me. But I look at my life, and Why did I feel so different? As far back as I can remember, I always thought there was something different about me as far as I can remember. Not that I felt terribly upset, but it just seemed as though other people were what they seemed to be, and I always had to pretend to be something. Like there were holes in my psychology. Like there was, for example, it always seemed to me that where other people were solid, I had a hole in the area that should protect you against being too sensitive to things. Sometimes I have a terrible tendency to get overly sensitive, and I react too much to things, and I feel things too intensely, and sometimes my feelings can be hurt so easily, and sometimes I want things to be right, and I look at other people, and they just, I know they have emotions, but they just kind of say, well, that's the way it is, and I just, makes me crazy. Sometimes when I'm feeling badly, I seem to have a lot of anxiety. I look over my life, I've had big, terrible periods of anxiety, wake up in the night with anxiety, and the worst part about it is, some of the anxiety I have had, you know, I know everybody has anxiety, but at least they know what they're anxious about. I have anxiety sometimes where I didn't know what the hell was I was anxious about. And that really is embarrassing, you know. I'm just so terribly anxious. What about? I don't know. It's almost a relief when something bad happens, you know. That's what I was anxious about. I knew it was coming. I seem to sometimes been in my life, used to study myself. Incidentally, let me say in passing, before I forget, if you ever want to guarantee that you will never feel good for any length of time, make a habit of examining yourself intermittently to see exactly how you're doing. How am I feeling today? Shit, I thought I was feeling good, but now I realize I don't. Yeah. Self-obsession is really a hideous drag. But one of the things I used to spot in myself, for example, was a lot of insecurity. And I got some pretty good jobs in my life. I worked in some pretty big joints. And I noticed that when you get those big jobs, that should make you feel wonderful. It just increases the insecurity somehow. Because you just have a feeling they're going to find me out. I don't know what the hell they're going to find out even. I know they're going to find out. It's almost a relief when it goes down the toilet again. Well, they never found out. I don't even recognize the feelings except in retrospect. Feelings of loneliness. I know that everybody gets lonely, but it's always seemed to me that I was old enough to identify it. I've always had a funny form of loneliness. Because my loneliness makes me sad and depressed. You know, I know people get lonely. I remember 35 years ago sitting in an office and hearing my secretary out there say, I was kind of lonely last night, so I called up Betty and we went to the show. Thinking, you simple bitch. I wish I were simple like that. Why have I been cursed with being so intricate? When I get lonely, I get sad. And if something doesn't happen to cheer me up, I get sadder and more lonely and more lonely until I get so lonely I can't bear to see anybody. And I would just as soon stay in bed and pull the covers over my head as get up and go anywhere. I know that's hard to explain. What are you doing under the covers? I'm lonely. Of course you're lonely, you fool. Sometimes all you can do is the last gasp of a broken spirit. Just release one arm from under the blanket. I have these and a lot of other feelings like them. And the main problem with them is they are wimp feelings. They're not even manly feelings. They're wimp feelings. They're what wimps would have. I want manly feelings. I'd rather die with manly feelings than live with wimp feelings. You know, because wimp, you can't even talk about wimp feelings. But maybe once you might try when you're a kid, say, tell how you feel. How you doing?
Oh, I'm kind of afraid.
What are you afraid of?
I don't know, just...
You discover quick that's the wrong answer. The right answer is, as you well know, how you feeling? Fine. And as you get older, you devise different postures, different disguises for different situations, for different people, so that you know that they are what they seem to be, and I have to somehow adjust to the people. And sometimes you're walking down the street, you have to adjust three or four postures to block, you know. Hello, Mr. Carlson.
What's that, baby?
You know, just going. Yes. And you just know that they're filling. And I went to college, I graduated from university, and I studied psychology, and I mean, I didn't major in psychology. I'm not that crazy. But I've sponsored several people who have. I sponsor a psychiatrist, and he's promised me as soon as he gets straightened out, he's going to fix me up. He should have his head examined. But these kind of feelings are, there's a name for them. And I studied about them, but I never recognized them. And it turns out everybody in the world has those kind of feelings. Those feelings of having to pretend. Those are called defense mechanisms. Those holds better than anything I ever heard of. And years later, I was still using whiskey to fill those holes. That's why I drink. I drink because when I drink, I don't get anxious. When I drink, I don't feel insecure. When I drink, I don't feel like a wimp. When I drink, I feel like I'm solid or should be, when it's working right and everything's going all right. That's the way it seems to me I should have felt all along. I now feel the way men look. And it wasn't for years I discovered nobody feels as well as they look. So I was feeling better than anybody, but I didn't know it. And the only problem I ever had in all those years is that because of my sensitivities and my various things I discovered in psychoanalysis, how I'd been repressed by religion as a child. Curse you, Reverend. They wanted me to act decent. I got deep sense of rejection from my parents when I was little. I'll tell you, I know there's an organization now where they sit around and discuss the shortcomings of their parents called Adult Children of Alcoholics. They should form one called Adult Children of Norwegian Lutherans. At least alcoholics pass out or leave once in a while. Norwegian Lutherans never do. And my parents, when I was a little boy, I discovered in psychoanalysis that I got a deep sense of rejection all my life that I'd been cursed with because my parents, during the Depression, were teachers, went off to live in other cities. And you know, it's the funny thing, I think about that, it never seemed to me that way because I was stayed with my grandparents. They were from Norway, and I was their only grandson they had for hundreds of miles. And they treated me like a little prince. And I could just, Grandma! And my grandma would make homemade root beer in the summertime, which leads through the Depression. I'd say, Grandma, I want some root beer. My grandma would say, look at here, Anton. He wants some root beer. Here's some root beer, sonny. My grandpa would say, and here's some cookies, too. When my parents came home, it all went to hell. I want some root beer. Not before dinner. What do you mean, not before dinner? I want some root beer. No. Yes. Why don't you go back to where you were? And then they left and gave me a lifelong feeling of rejection. I discovered I'd been deprived as a child. I hadn't known that. Raised in the Depression. Didn't have anything. Didn't know it. Years later, sitting in this guy's office one day, he says, "You mean to say, Mr. Emerson, at this time in 1935, you're 8 years old, you didn't even have a bicycle?" I said, "No." But I got thinking about it on the way home. I never had anything now that I think about it. For about 2 months after that, every time I wanted to throw myself into a depression, all I had to do was visualize a little tousled-haired, apple-cheeked, blue-eyed little tyke standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles. Don't worry about me. I'll go into psychoanalysis. When I think about it now, I could almost... It took me almost 2 months, you remember. In 1935, nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle. One kid did. We thought he was a freak. We beat him up and broke his bicycle. But psychoanalysis did one thing for me, gave me the first series of answers to why I had these feelings, and I believed them to be valid. Then later I got into metaphysics, and I found another series of reasons why I had these feelings. And I read books to find out why, and I talked to people to find out why. Because my lifelong search has been, I got to find out why I feel like this, and I'll get rid of it. And I'm sure in this room, there are many people who are in the midst of searching, why do I feel like this? I'm going to tell you some bad news. I'm full of bad news tonight. You will discover finding out why doesn't help. There's a certain elation, and then it goes away again. Now you feel crappy, but you know why. The only use it is late at night in a bar where some guy says, "Hey, what the hell's wrong with you?" Then you can tell him. Why is really extraneous. The best analogy I've ever been able to think of for my life, or lives like mine, it's as though I'm riding on the deck of the Titanic and hit the iceberg and down it goes. And everybody rows away as fast as they can. And people like me say, "I'm not getting off this baby till I find out why this happened." And you may find out why, but it's a kind of a hollow victory, you know. "You dummies in the boats! I know why." It takes a while to discover in this world, knowing why is of no value. The number one thing, get off your sinking ship and roll like a son of a bitch. But I always, my problem, as I say, I use alcohol to fill the holes. That's all. And the only major problem I had in my life with it is that I have an unfortunate tendency to overfill my holes. To overshoot from time to time. And my body seems to have no runoff mechanism. So it gets right to the electrical work sometimes. And another change takes place sometimes. And there have been moments when policemen and judges have accused me of being bizarre. Of course, what they meant by bizarre then was a long way different from what I feel like bizarre now. I could be as bizarre as I was, I'd be student chaplain. But, you know, being bizarre is okay when you're a kid. It's kind of fun, you know. Boy, did we have fun after the prom last night. I peed in the hotel lobby. But as you get older, being bizarre gets to be a handicap after a while. When you have a wife and children who demand room and board and trying to hold on to jobs. And so I fell into the pattern then of trying to drink and then control my drinking. And I've stopped drinking from time to time, and I realized that was not the answer. When I went to my first AA meeting, went to a few AA meetings in 1949, I tried to stop drinking. I had no idea. AA was only 14 years old then. At 14 years before that, there was no place to go. Just place been there forever as far as I could see. Bunch of old fools, it's like God's waiting room, just all sitting around waiting for some voice to come out of heaven saying, next, and one of them would get up and say, okay. But they talked about stopping drinking. I stopped drinking for a while, and they talked about returning to God, and that didn't do much for me because I already knew more. One of the great reasons I could not really want to hear the God stuff is because I already knew too much about God. If God existed, I was damned. So the only defense I could have, there's no God. I don't want to hear about that God. In fact, that went on for years, years and years later. I was intermittently trying to stay sober today. I remember, you know, just get off me with this God crap. Old lady came up to me after me and went, oh, sonny, she said, just hate to see you fight God. I remember thinking, took all of every fiber of my being not to say, well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again. But AA is designed for people who have a problem with drinking. I discover when I stop drinking, there's a nice feeling. But it goes away, and the holes form again. And they get worse. And I need to drink to fill the holes. I got to be careful I don't. And then comes the ongoing pattern. Have I got to find a way to do this and get it together just so I can get things together? If you're new tonight, if you're kind of new around AA, you may wonder, what do all the alcoholics have in common? What do we all have in common? Our size, how much we drank, where we drank. These aren't things we have in common. You'll find all the stories are different. The one thing we have in common, I believe, is that we all, through this peculiar illness, have been pushed into a position we did not recognize, that's untenable, and is quoted in our book exactly, where we have been forced into an obsessive belief that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. I've got to believe that, or else I got to commit suicide. Because without it, it's just too much. I was committed once to the Texas State Insane Asylum. I just got done directing a grand opera at the University of Texas. And the next year I was in the Texas Insane Asylum. And I was there, nothing on my commitment paper said alcohol. I was there as a psychotic, and the reason they thought I was a psychotic is because I'd committed suicide. I had successfully committed suicide, and a guy found me in the garage with the motor running, and my heart had stopped, and they pulled me out and got me going to the psych ward, and then put me in this Texas State Insane Asylum. And they were in there because they had me classified as a badly split personality, a schizophrenic. The reason I was in there is because my wife was pregnant again. You have no idea what a pressure that is on a husband. I'd married this Catholic girl who had many virtues, but had a real weak spot in the area of birth control. I'd say, you know, this is the post we have to listen to what some fool in Rome says. Let's use birth control.
No.
I said, how about just getting something for the prevention of disease? They sell it over here in Rocky's Rockaway in a vending machine.
No.
She had some priest come by and he gave me an hour and a half on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened, and I couldn't pick up that beat. So I had also become, in all of my other problems, a national distributor of small Catholics. Jesus. If I'd known they were going to grow up to marry AA members, I'd have taken a cold shower. I'm sure your father feels the same. I was trying to hold this job. They told me I couldn't drink, so I stopped drinking. And it got so bad, and I had my wife and little children there. I was writing days in an advertising agency. I was on the faculty of this university at night. I was doing the weekly sports column. I tried to do everything, and one day I just couldn't stand it. I felt so anxiety and terrible and lonely and sad and wanted to scream, and I couldn't drink. I just waited. My wife took the kids to church. I put the car in the garage and turned around, hooked up a hose, went to sleep and died. As I said, they took me to the psych ward and determined I was a split personality and committed me for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life in the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. And I'll tell you something. When you're trying to hold it together and you're trying to do something for your family and you don't want to be in this position and you want to make up for other times and you realize that you've been committed for possibly the rest of your life to a state insane asylum, you have a feeling this will not look good on my resume. There's going to be a little gap here, 70 years or so. But I finally got out of there because they put it in an alcoholic ward the next year. And if I'd been around AA by 7 years by that time, I knew how to act like an alcoholic. And I got out. I beat him by pretending to be an alcoholic. But I've often thought about that psychiatrist that evaluated me. I thought, I'd like to go back and find him someday. I went by that hospital just last year. I almost went in, but I thought, no. But he should be old and feeble by now. I should be able to move him around pretty good. You quack! You call yourself a psychiatrist. You examined me and gave me tests, and your determination was that I was a dual personality. You crazy old bastard! If I could have gotten my personalities down to two, I'd have made it. My life has always been characterized by a crippled committee that limps into session every time there's a conflict.
No. What do you think we're going to do? No. I don't know. Let's make a run for it. Can't. You're crippled. Shit. Well,
I hear people talk about how they felt they should go to group therapy. Not me. All I ever had to do was go for a ride alone in my car. That's why I drink, because drinking makes it only one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. And when I go to AA, and little by little it all went down the toilet, and the last day I stood in the Skid Row streets, if a man would have put a lie detector on my arm and see you sitting alcoholic, I said, no, I'm not. Not really. It looks like it, and I smell like it, and I can pass for one. But my case is different. You don't understand. I am not a bum. I'm a well-respected, I was, once upon a time, writer. I had a lot of triumphs. I've had my name and pictures in the papers all over the country for things I've done. And now, because there's something wrong with my emotions, I'm in a position where people can treat me like a piece of crap and I have to take it. And that's something. And I walked off Skid Row one day and walked out of the AA club where I'd been before and they didn't want me to come back, but I talked to them and let me come in. The way I beat him at the Texas Dunt House, I pretended to be an alcoholic. And so I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous this time, and I was very close to dying. I thought, I'm going to pretend to be an alcoholic till I can get it together. I have no alternative at the moment. I'm going to pretend to be an alcoholic. I don't have to get better for my kids and my wife because they're gone, and my parents have ripped me off. And I don't have to be anything for anybody. I can pretend to be an alcoholic. And I got a sponsor, as I said, who was a tough guy, and he was intimidating to me, in a sense, I think he was the only one who might have helped me, or people like that. I'll tell you something funny. When you are really suffering from a lack of self-worth, no self-acceptance, people who love you and are kind to you, you really appreciate them, but you don't respect them because they're too easily fooled. You respect the people who see through you and see what a piece of crap you are, even though you hate them for doing it. You respect them. When you're in trouble, you turn to people you respect. That's what a sponsor's for, someone you respect. You can hate that old son of a bitch most of the time, but when the chips are down, you better have some there that you can respect, and he'll give you a straight answer. And say, he won't say like your friend will say, oh, nothing's wrong. It's all right. Don't worry. A lot of people's houses are on fire. Don't worry. I have to someone just turn on your hose and put it out, you dumb shit. Since I get this out, I'm going back to resenting you, I'll tell you that. And he made me do things and take actions that I thought were below my intellectual level. I never would have done them any other time. But I was so down that I was doing them. I felt sad because I was selling out what I felt was my integrity. I took actions and did things, and over a period of time, it was a very long, difficult period. I lived in the back seat of an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot. I didn't have any front teeth, and I had kind of a smart mouth sometimes, and people didn't like me. I look at this. This guy used to come by every once in a while and say, hey, Clancy, want an apple? Ha, 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 ha. Yeah. Yeah, you're funny. Yeah. Joe Quinn. And the only thing that saved me is that by a coincidence, nothing I did or there's nothing that could help me. It was all just stupid. By a lucky coincidence, I start feeling better during that year. No thanks to them, I'll tell you that. About time I got a break. And things got pretty good. By the time I was a year sober, I was working again and continued from there. And now it's a couple weeks from now, it'll be 29 years since I walked off Skid Row that morning, dying on the streets of Los Angeles. And I've... No. Take up a birthday love offering. Unless I get $1,000, God is going to make me stay in Montana. See those wallets come out right away. I'll check when you get somebody out of here. And that's very nice, but I'll tell you something funny. The only therapy I've had since 1958 is Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's people, and it's in fellowship, and it's steps, and it's involvements. And I have been a very, very imperfect member of AA. I'm very emotional. By getting sober doesn't make you feel better. Getting sober makes you feel worse. Then you got to work at it from there. But I've been very imperfect. I've been, many times I've fallen short of what I want to be. Other times I've done better than I ever thought I could. So it's, but little by little, as you go along, the road straightens out, little by little. What I sometimes think about is this. Today we are living in a world, I'm sober, you're sober. They estimate maybe 1.5 million sober people. Now that means, I guess, old Dr. Jung was wrong in 1931 when he said, everyone that's an alcoholic must either keep themselves confined or else they will drink intermittently until they go mad or die. And maybe 1 in 1 million or 1 in 5 million will have a spiritual experience. That would mean there's 3 ways out for us. But I'll tell you something. I don't know. I knew Bill Wilson. And I sat in his office, talked to him, and I've met him many times. But he's the only person I've ever known who has had a true spiritual experience. There may be others, but most spiritual experiences are just kind of semi-breakthroughs that people have. But this is a complete changeover. Now, how in the world can I stay sober? Is Dr. Jung wrong? How can you stay sober? Is Dr. Jung wrong? I think Dr. Jung is absolutely right. And everything I've ever learned or seen in AA proves that to me. But you say, but you got to have a spiritual experience. Yeah, but you can't order one. How do you get one?
And nobody, you don't know anybody who's got one, and yet they're staying sober. What is this? It goes back to the one thing Katrina read tonight that's been changed since this book was first published in early 1939. She read the 12 steps as part of chapter 5 tonight. One word in the 12 steps has been changed from the first printing of the first edition. First printing, first edition said, and I quote, "Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs." And after the book came out, Bill's followers went up and said, "Bill, that's wrong. We haven't had any spiritual experience. You're the only one who's had a spiritual experience. And you didn't have it as a result of these steps. You had it before you even had the steps." And they thought, yeah, that's right. That's wrong. That's wrong. How are people staying sober? What's going on? How could we? And they started to get the glimmer of something, I guess. And little by little they begin to understand it. We are still learning more about it today. But here's the odd thing. It turns out, apparently, that whether by God's hand or coincidence or luck of the draw, whatever it might be, call it whatever you want to, somehow or other, these 12 steps do something that nothing has ever done in the history of alcoholic therapeutic. They bring about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his. Boom! But the way we get ours. Make amends to that bitch. And the net result is we wind up with an incremental spiritual experience. That's why the second edition of the book, and for all editions thereafter, the 12th step has been changed. It's having had a spiritual awakening as the result of those steps. And that's a good thing to remember. You know, in AA, we see them all the time. Not all the time. Every so often. There's always some old sour-faced boob who's always sober. A lot of years, and I didn't do that goddamn inventory. I didn't do that. It's hard to, you know, I've had newcomers at meetings where a guy's sober twice as long as I did at that time. I remember I was sober 5 years, and this guy speak 10 years. I don't run your goddamn inventory. I don't see any need for it. And on the way home, this new guy, I've been trying to get him to write his inventory. He says, geez, he's over 10 years. He didn't write his inventory. Why should I write my inventory? And God gave me the answer. Is that the way you want to feel after 10 years? When an alcoholic who has not done these things and is feeling better than I'm feeling comes around, I want to talk to him. That's why I do them. That's why, and the other thing to think about is, so are we all going to do them? What's the big deal? But yet most people won't do them. Because why? What you say is true, but my case is different. Today there's a lot of discussion all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous of who can be a member of AA. There's a lot of problems because we talked a little bit about that in our traditions meeting today. Some of the treatment centers, in order to make it more economically feasible for them, lump everything together. Say, they're all drugs, alcohol, cocaine. Therefore, we just have one ward, get you all in there, straighten you out. And there's a lot of talk about that. Nowhere else in the world, except in those treatment centers, is that philosophy come from. But it sounds reasonable as, here, they're all drugs together, we should all come to AA together. False. False. And the people who have the other problems realize that. Since I have been sober, a guy I knew and got another friend, and they formed Narcotics Anonymous because they could not identify at AA meetings. Some women I knew founded Overeaters Anonymous. In fact, some of us spoke at their first meetings. There wasn't anybody successful yet, so we talked about obsessions. Until I got someone lost some weight. I was very skinny then. I really felt embarrassed. I suppose you're wondering what a skinny guy like me is doing talking to old fat old broads, eh? They never invited me back. I don't know. And a couple of years after that, a guy I knew named Jim Willis, Sybil, some of you know Sybil, her ex-husband, founded Gamblers Anonymous. And about 10 or 12 years ago, somebody found Cocaine Anonymous. Why? Why do they need programmed to the same steps? It isn't the steps. It's the identification that'll get the guy willing to take the steps. When Bill Wilson called on Dr. Bob and met him in Akron, Ohio, Dr. Bob wrote a letter. He said, a lot of people have tried to help me, but he was the first man I ever talked to who seemed to know how I felt and why I drank. And that old boob up in the Akron hospital, them two fellers, didn't talk to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt. But it turned out to be just the way I felt. And on. That's why we have to establish identification. Because the bottom line of AA, the thing that makes the steps viable, the thing that makes all we do here, it is not service structure, it is not conventions, it's not even meetings. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to try to help him break down his feelings of being different enough so he will take actions he doesn't yet believe in. That's what it's all about. And if you do that, you've got someone else getting well. And if you continue to do that, they stay sober. And if they stop doing it, they go back to drinking after a while. Because this is an incremental thing. As we incrementally do the steps, apparently we incrementally lose them again, too, if we stop. It's a funny thing. You don't just go out and get drunk. The man who taught me that, my sponsor, I watched him do it for a year. He finally had a drink and died. Because he got mad at AA because the group he founded changed the format on him or something. And he got very mad. And I understood it, but I said, geez, you ought to go to meetings, Bob. Ah, screw him. And the next sponsor I got was the most active man I knew in AA. I didn't much like him. He was too spiritual for my taste at that time. But he was active. And his actions pulled me along, and my actions have kept me here, and as long as I'm active, I'll stay here. And not because I'm wonderful, I'm a fallible, weak, emotional person. Some days you'd think, for God's sakes, I'd never been to AA. When they were doing all that shooting on the freeway down there, I thought, shit, why didn't I think of that? Then I got a ticket for carrying a .22 in a .45 caliber lane. Well, that's not true, is it? But what makes AA so miraculous? Not that it works for wonderful people. It works for fallible people and emotional people. And no matter how badly you fail at any given day, you can, if you wish, pray to a God you come to believe in here, as I do, and just help me know thy will tomorrow to do it a little bit better. And I don't always do it very well, but I know this, I'm sober and I'm sane. When I was sober about 5 years, the same wife and all those children moved out here to California. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another little Catholic hit the streets. Fortunately, I got a time machine that helps me now. I'll tell you one other thing that helps me, too. It may give you some hope, Kenny. I don't know, it wouldn't. But I discovered some years ago that I was in the Merchant Marine early in the Second World War, and then I went in the Navy. And I found out later, years later, that in the Navy, in the Second World War, I guess the Merchant Marine, they put saltpeter in the food. So the guy, if you don't know saltpeter, it's a sexual depressant. So when you're out in a ship too long, you don't get edgy and start eyeing the messmen, you know. I must have eaten pounds of that crap. It never seemed to have any effect on me. I was always edgy and nervous and fantasizing about the other guy's pictures. And that's your mother? Oh. But I'll tell you something funny about saltpeter. Mine just kicked in about 2 years ago. You can just hang on long enough, you become spiritual.
But what I'm trying to say, in effect, is this. There's a lot of people in the world who can live sober. There's a lot of people who are going to die in agony because they feel they've allowed the feeling of being different to overpower through other things. Here we learn you act through the feelings of being different. You take actions. It'd be nice to have a sponsor that you're a little afraid of, so you don't have to think he's your chum or she's your chum. You go to these meetings, you get involved, and you try to do as Bill and Dr. Bob did. You can't not go to the Akron Hospital, but you find some other boob to carry that message to and reinforce your own belief. And that's the purpose of AA. That's what it's all about. Not to become wonderful, not to become some imitation savior, but to a program that, at least for me, has enabled me, for example, to come to believe in a God that is not a God who wishes me evil. I remember last year, a year and a half ago, saying the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, next to my mother's little casket, waiting for the sermon, waiting for the funeral. I think, isn't that nice? God is just as, same God as in here, as in the meetings, as everywhere else. Just, God means me well. I'm so glad somebody got my immaturity out of the way. So I could have stayed immature till I died from it. But through people and grace of God and power of the fellowship and 12 steps that have no equivalent in the world, and a series of actions that keep me feeling less different in critical times, I have not had to drink or run away for a long time. I live with some modicum of dignity. I do what's expected of me. I try to be a good father. I try to be a providing husband. I try to be a good employee. I try to be a good employer. All of that's very nice, but all of those are absolutely secondary. The number one thing is, nearly always, at the end of the day, when I go to bed, I go to sleep, I'm not much, but I'm doing better than I ever did before. I think it's worth everything it takes. So let's stay here. Let's not listen to the siren calls of people who have a better way. And people say, you don't have to do this. Because we've been, those kind of crap heads have been around for years. But I'll tell you one thing. They won't do your misery for you. And they won't do your agony for you. And when you go down the toilet, they won't be around to make it better for you. If there was a better way, I would have found it. This is the best way I know. I hope we all stay here. Thank you.